This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. Before we get started, I just want to take a moment to address the elephant in the recording closet. You may have heard that Only a Game is ending in September after a 27-year run. But never fear, we have some amazing episodes planned between now and then. You're really not going to want to miss them. Meanwhile, there's a lot to talk about this week, especially regarding the Black Lives Matter movement and athletes speaking out against racism. So we're going to begin our show with three stories you should know. I'm thrilled to welcome back the Washington Post Jerry Brewer and The Athletic's Michael Lee. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you, Karen.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Jerry, you want to talk about Oklahoma State head football coach Mike Gundy. Can you start us off?
Well, Michael and Karen, if you Google dumb things Mike Gundy has said, you get 301,000 results. You know, since the outbreak of the coronavirus, he has said that, you know, his players need to get back in on campus and help funnel money through the state of Oklahoma. He had to apologize for that. This week, he was caught wearing a One America News Network t-shirt. One America News is a right-wing network that spreads often flat lies and has consistently been opposed to the Black Lives Matter movement. He allowed himself to be photographed wearing it. It enraged his players. His star player, Chuba Hubbard, maybe the best running back in college football, took to social media and simply said, "This is a slap in our face. We demand better." Ultimately, Chuba and Mike Gundy meet. They have this ridiculous video in which Chuba apologizes.
"I'll start off by first saying that I went about it the wrong way by tweeting. I should have went to him as a man."
Mike Gundy does not apologize. He just accepts it.
"I realize it's a very sensitive issue with what's going on in today's society."
Says we're going to move forward. And then a day later, after criticism that would make Drew Brees even blush, Mike Gundy officially apologizes, and it was a fairly weak apology. The larger question, however, is in this movement, in this Black Lives Matter movement, it's predominantly led by young people and college students, prospective college athletes should use this moment to scrutinize who they're going to be playing for more.
I mean, yeah, I think players are starting to understand their power. Players are starting to recognize that these coaches are making millions of dollars and we're not seeing any of it. You know, you need to take care of us. And the fact that he called them out on Twitter, they have a lot of ways to sort of spread their message. This is a new generation and they see just the professional athletes sort of setting the tone that they're no longer going to be silent. And I will say this about that apology. You can't have a sincere apology where it looks like a hostage video. And you can't look like you're reading from a script if people are going to believe you. The apology probably did more damage than any good because no one believed that he was sincere in anything that he said.
Yeah, I want to continue to talk about that apology, and we're going to play a little clip.
"I had a great meeting with our team today. Our players expressed their feelings as individuals and as team members. They helped me see through their eyes how the t-shirt affected their hearts."
I mean, he just sounds so scripted and so fake. I really do not believe that he's actually sorry about anything. And Jerry, to your point, he's clearly just saying this so he doesn't immediately lose his entire recruiting class, right?
Yes, he's trying to save face. In a lot of ways, he's trying to save his job. And now everyone's looking back into your past and they're was a report when he was the quarterback at Oklahoma State from 1989 of him using the N-word and upsetting some opponents. The OAN t-shirt in connection with how callous he has been about humanity, not just issues affecting Black people, but just humanity in general. You know, how you can talk about running money through the state of Oklahoma, and that's the reason that your players who don't get compensated on anything other than a scholarship, that they got to come back to campus. You know, all of his actions give more credibility that this is someone that on issues of humanity cannot be trusted.
Absolutely. All right, Michael, you're next.
Well, we all know that the world shut down the moment the NBA decided that it was going to suspend its season after the discovery that Rudy Gobert contracted COVID-19. Well, now the NBA wants to come back, and they've chosen to go to Orlando, where all dreams come true. The 22 teams that go down to the NBA's bubble are going to be staying in, you know, the resorts. Teams with better records get better hotels. Some players have, like Dwight Howard, have said that it's not the time to be playing, so they want to not play at all to continue to drive the Black Lives Matter agenda. The NBA is in a tough spot because, on one hand, they have to respect the players. You know, you have a predominantly Black league. Black Lives Matter movement directly affects them and their families and their loved ones. But then you have this coronavirus, which is something that threatened to shut down this entire nation. And even though nothing has happened to give us any encouragement that we've passed, you know, this first wave of COVID, they're trying to play basketball through it, which could put their players' health at risk. And I'm just wondering if they're actually going to pull this off, because it just seems just too ambitious.
This is an incredibly difficult one, because I do think that there is value in coming back now, particularly in giving your players, your star players, your most prominent players, the LeBron Jameses of the league, the platform to speak to the cause. And it's going to need a boost at some point. People's stamina for marching and for demanding change is going to minimize. And in a perfect world, it would be a perfect time for the NBA to rise in Disney and just show this wonderful Mickey Mouse world, you know, the right way to do things. However, the risks are tremendous. We have to mention that Adam Silver's plan has been supported by epidemiologists and other health experts as being incredibly thorough. What they cannot do is give it more than a decent chance of working, because we just don't know enough about this virus to know what the long-term effects exactly are. And my concern, in addition to the appropriateness of it and the message that you're sending the world, is they know that they have a decent chance of preventing just a wildfire spread of it. But they can't say for certain that if LeBron James gets this, what the damage exactly is going to be to his lungs and if he'll come back and be the same player.
I'm really fascinated by the confluence of concerns here, right? It's not just one thing. There are the safety concerns related to COVID-19, but also safety concerns related to, like, springing into the end of the season after a long layoff, you know, injury concerns. There are very understandable concerns about players being asked to spend so much time away from friends and family. And then, of course, there is the argument that, near as I can tell, this sentiment hasn't been this strong since maybe the lead up to the 68 Olympic Games, where athletes are saying, maybe now is not the time to be entertaining people. Maybe now it's time to be heard by refusing to play. Michael, were you able to get a sense of which of these factors is most at play here?
I believe that the social justice aspect is actually the one that's most at play. A lot of players aren't intimidated by contracting coronavirus. They feel like they have the immune systems to sort of get through it and be okay. I mean, you got to remember at least 15 players had the coronavirus or tested positive for it. So they feel like they could survive that. There is a lot of resistance to the restrictions. And then being away from your family the first 7 weeks, you won't really be able to be in contact with them. So there is a resistance from that end. But then the health aspect of it, too. You mentioned injury a little bit earlier. And for me, just honestly, when you think about how terrible this season has been for the NBA, beginning with China.
They are in hot water in China. And that's over a tweet supporting pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. And it's
then you had David Stern passing, you had Kobe Bryant passing, which really struck a lot of these guys emotionally. And the league has just been pushing through. Then you had COVID come. For me, I sort of felt like this is an unnecessary gamble. It's like you're at the craps table, you've lost all your money, and all you got left is your watch. And now the NBA is like, we got to get this $1 billion, and all we have is this watch to gamble, but we're going to put that watch on the table. I just don't know if it's the right time, considering what's happening in Orlando, in Orange County in particular, where the virus is raging stronger than ever.
All right, so I want to talk about something that came up as we were recording interviews for next week's show, which, by the way, is all about sports racism and the myth of meritocracy. Anyway, one of our guests, Kirsten Heckstrom, who studies this sort of thing at the University of Oklahoma, had a suggestion for what our next special episode should be, also related to the Black Lives Matter movement.
I hope you're going to do one on just the blatant hypocrisy of college coaches who are saying they are for these movements, yet are asking predominantly Black athletes to come back during COVID.
There's a great piece in the Wall Street Journal this week about the risks of bringing back football in particular. Football teams are very large, social distancing is impossible, and many football players fall into at-risk groups. Many of them are Black, and Blacks have been disproportionately dying from this disease. Many of them have high body mass indexes and sleep apnea. So is Kirsten right? Is it hypocritical to be saying Black Lives Matter while also saying practice begins at 10, Jerry?
For amateur athletes, quote unquote amateur athletes, college athletes and lower, I would say yes. In the professional ranks, you have to collectively bargain it. And so I think in that sense, you have a voice. I think it is an embarrassment the way that college athletics is handling it. I mean, they're already got these kids back on campus and they're telling other students that campus is not safe enough to be on. I haven't heard any college coaches say, it's okay if you don't come back, we'll keep your scholarship for you. They're not going to say that. I think what they're doing is both premature and irresponsible. And to do it at any level lower, you know, we start getting into high school and then you start getting into, you know, little league. That is malpractice, the way I look at it.
I don't know if I can add any more than Jerry just said. He broke it all the way down to the very last compound. I will say that it's really reckless because you know that these players are coming from, a lot of these players are coming from environments where this is their hope for an education. This is a hope for a better life, possibly a hope for the NFL, and they're trying to get somewhere. So when you hold that carrot in front of them, that if you want to have success in life, then this is what you have to do, then you leave them no option and you put their lives at danger. If people wind up dying because of this, I mean, who's going to be to blame? We can't point it at these kids. We have to point it to the adults who know that they're putting them at risk.
I could not possibly say it any better than that. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Washington Post's Jerry Brewer and The Athletic's Michael Lee. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Karen.
Hey, thank you.
After the Arab Spring, Tunisia banned all large gatherings, which meant fans weren't allowed to attend sporting events.
The fear was that anytime people were allowed to gather in those kinds of numbers, it might turn political and they wouldn't be able to contain it.
How one Tunisian soccer team made its empty stadium sound less empty. Coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Hey, y'all, I'm Sam Sanders, host of It's Been a Minute. There is a lot going on in the world. So on my show, my guest and I make sense of the news and culture through conversation. It feels like we're living in three movies at once.
That's a good way to put it.
It feels like a Mike Judge movie. It feels like a Spike Lee movie. And it feels like a Michael Bay movie. Like
Every Tuesday and Friday, listen and subscribe now to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
I'm Karen Given. First, it was baseball in Taiwan and South Korea. Then it was soccer. First, Germany's Bundesliga. And now, this week, England's Premier League. Sports are starting to come back. And as they come back, leagues around the world are trying to figure out how to make the games look and feel less empty. The New York Times' Rory Smith recently wrote about how one well-known Premier League team once solved the empty grandstand problem, though this story is a bit of a cautionary tale. Rory Smith, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so the year was 1992. The team was Arsenal. There was obviously no pandemic forcing fans to stay at home. So what was the problem?
Well, so in 1989, English football suffered the Hillsborough disaster, which involved the death of 96 Liverpool fans, partly because of a kind of rotting terrace at a stadium in Sheffield. And that led to the Taylor Report, which was a government investigation which made it clear that English football had to update its stadiums. So every club in England had to do something about their stadiums, and some of them kind of put in seats while they were playing, some of them knocked down certain stands and rebuilt them. And Arsenal, which had its old stadium, Highbury, the kind of hardcore Arsenal fans gathered on the north bank of Highbury, which is one of the ends of the stadium, and it needed to be knocked down to be replaced with an all-seater stand. So Arsenal's vice chairman at the time, a man called David Dean, decided that what they would do would be to play the season while the stand was still being built. You didn't want loads of sort of cement trucks and cranes spoiling the spectacle. They would hide the construction work with a mural that made it look like there were fans there. And David Dean felt that this was the best way out of the problem.
So David Dean, he enlisted an artist to help him with this solution. So who did he bring in to help out?
He contacted a firm called January, and they handed it to an artist of theirs, a resident artist by the name of Mike Ibison, who happened to be an Arsenal fan. And they basically said to him, look, we've got this commission for a mural of fans. What does that look like? And I guess because that had never been done before, he got to run with the full gamut of his imagination.
All right. So this mural was designed and then painted by hand. And the whole process took like a month. And then it was hung in place. And no one during this entire time noticed that there was something wrong with it?
No. This is where it becomes, as you say, a slightly cautionary tale about subconscious bias. So Mike, in his recollection, basically drew a vision of a crowd, a mural basically encompassing the whole width of the pitch, on which were painted lots and lots of Arsenal fans celebrating, wearing jerseys, holding scarves aloft. He didn't give anybody an ethnicity. If you actually look really closely at the mural, they're basically formless human shapes. He wasn't trying to create a kind of cross-section of Arsenal fans. It was just, here are some human shapes in Arsenal shirts. And so when the mural was mounted on a scaffold in front of the North Bank, it did its job. It hid the scaffolding, it hid the cement trucks, it hid the cranes. Everybody thought, that looks great. This is exactly what we needed. And the day before the first game of the season, Arsenal were invited to go through one final training session on the pitch. And two of the team's black players, Kevin Campbell and Ian Wright, were warming up. And Kevin Campbell, after a few minutes, turned to Ian Wright and said, look at the mural. So Ian Wright did. And Kevin Campbell said, what can't you see? And Ian Wright stared at the mural for a while and eventually thought, I have no idea what this man is talking about. Please enlighten me. And Kevin Campbell said, there are no black faces. And he was quite right. And as Kevin Campbell came off the field that day, David Dean was walking around the side of the pitch. And Kevin Campbell stopped him and said, there are no black faces in this mural. And David Dean looked up and, I suppose to his credit, said, yep, you're absolutely right, that's unacceptable. Arsenal at the time was well known, really, for having a much more diverse fan base than most teams. This is still the very early 90s in England, when it was only a few years beforehand that soccer really hadn't been a welcoming environment to any people of colour. It was not a safe place a lot of the time for anyone of colour, or families, or women, or anyone who wasn't basically a white male to be. Arsenal famously had quite a diverse fan base and was very proud of that fact. And David Dean recognised immediately that it was not acceptable to whitewash that element of the club's identity. And that night, the mural was amended, that black faces were painted in. And by the time of the first game, the mural contained a much more accurate depiction of Arsenal's traditional fan base than it would have done otherwise.
And then this story kind of enters urban legend territory, because there are all sorts of rumors about what happened next.
That, in a way, kind of adds to the story of the mural. There are theories that it was repainted again to include women, which everybody involved denies. There's then a story that it was repainted yet again because all of the amendments had meant that lots of children weren't with their parents, which kind of, I guess, would have annoyed people who believe that parents should look after children, I suppose. And then there are kind of the apocryphal tales that some nuns were painted into the mural, a Manchester United fan was painted into the mural. Everybody denies this. Everybody involved says that the mural was amended once to reflect the actual diversity of Arsenal's fan base and never again. But it has kind of obtained this slightly mythical status of this enormous kind of error that Arsenal made.
One of the things I love about this story is that normally you would just be able to go and say, look at the mural and be like, how many times does it look like it's been repainted? Who's in it? Are there nuns? But we can't do that. So what happened to this mural after it came down?
That's an extremely good question. It has effectively disappeared without trace. Mike Ibbison, who I guess owns the intellectual property to the mural, not only doesn't know where the mural itself is, but doesn't know where his original sketch is. So there is kind of nothing to check it by. There are theories, there are rumours that the mural was cut up and kind of given to fans as a keepsake, which would be nice and kind of romantic and would vaguely make sense, but then not many Arsenal fans at the time regarded it particularly fondly, partly, I think, because of the controversy that grew up around it, but partly because Arsenal had a really bad season that year. And as all fans know, if there's a scapegoat to be had, you use that scapegoat. So that Arsenal's bad season became the fault of the mural. So I'm not sure there's anyone who would particularly want to have this sort of cursed mural in their house. But as things stand, no one I spoke to knows where any of it is, which is extraordinary given the sheer scale of it. It's a stadium-sized thing, and it has disappeared completely without trace.
Well, clearly in 2020, organizations are much more aware of the importance of representation than they were in 1992. But still, are there lessons teams should take from this story as they try to make their venues look and feel less empty?
I think there are lessons for all of us. I don't think that Mike Ibbison set out to draw a white crowd. I don't think that David Dean envisaged only having white faces on that mural. I don't think there was any kind of conscious decision that we want this mural to be white. I don't think there was a conscious decision to erase black identity within the mural or to whitewash Arsenal's fan base. But what it proves, I think, is that we are all susceptible to our own unconscious biases. Both David Dean and Mike Ibbison sort of felt that that mistake wouldn't happen now, but it happens all of the time. Companies advertise products and they use exclusively white models, or they market in a way that speaks to white people and not to black people or to people of colour. We would all like to think that it couldn't happen again. I think the evidence is that it does happen continually. And maybe the lesson to be learned from the North Bank mural is that we just need to be aware, that we need to be careful. We need to be mindful of what society looks like and aware of the way that we think and the shortcomings within that.
Rory Smith covers European soccer for the New York Times. We'll have a link to his piece, "The Shirts Were Red, The Fans Were All White," at onlyagame.org. Thanks, Rory.
Thank you very much for having me.
Moving on now from how to make an empty stadium look less empty to how to make it sound less empty. The answer might seem simple. Just pump in some fan noise, right? Not so fast, says The Wall Street Journal's Andrew Beaton.
Throughout recent history of sports, people have really turned their nose at the idea of pumping in crowd noise to stadiums. You know, it was almost seen as a form of odd cheating.
The problem, Andrew says, is authenticity. Fake crowd noise, no matter how well it's done, just feels fake. But in March of 2013, a Tunisian soccer team called Hammam Leaf positioned 40 speakers around their home stadium and invited their fans to cheer on the team for real. Sort of. Here's Joshua Robinson. He works with Andrew at The Wall Street Journal.
They had come up with a kind of workaround to let fans make their voices heard in real time.
Okay, so in a lot of ways, this story starts with the Arab Spring.
There's a tsunami going on in the Arab Middle East. The Arab Spring is changing governments everywhere.
Galvanized by uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt, the Arab Spring took hold in Libya.
Algeria, Kuwait, and Morocco are also experiencing political unrest.
One of the interesting things is while globally we paid attention to it in countries such as Egypt and others much more, Tunisia was actually in a lot of ways the launching off point for what became a really phenomenally important movement.
The so-called Arab Spring dawned in Tunisia and changed the face of the Arab world.
A 27-year-old Tunisian man
set himself on fire in an anti-government protest.
That single act
prompted weeks of demonstrations.
They were asking three things: freedom, democracy, and social justice.
The effect of the spring lasted for years. They banned all large gatherings, and so you couldn't have sports games, which had been tens of thousands of people, because the fear was that any time people were allowed to gather in those kinds of numbers, there might be another riot. It might turn political, and they wouldn't be able to contain it.
So we're in March of 2013. That's 2 years after the start of the Arab Spring. Fans are still at home, and a soccer club called Hammam Leaf is facing relegation. Can you describe this team for me?
You know, it's a team that even in Tunisia, there are bigger clubs. There are clubs that have had more success. This wasn't exactly a powerhouse, but this soccer club is a point of pride in a soccer-obsessed nation. And this is a city that clearly loved its soccer team, but also had no way to actually go and show their support for them when they were on the brink.
And that's where an advertising and marketing agency called Memak Ogilvy enters the picture. Josh, who are they and what had they been working on?
So they're a major international ad firm, and they had been toying with an app that would allow fans to somehow participate in the atmosphere. The atmosphere, as we've all found out recently, is pretty weird in an empty stadium when you can hear the players and the coaches and there's nothing else going on. There's no soundtrack. What the app did was allow them to broadcast a number of cheers or noises via a speaker system in the stadium just by tapping their phone screens.
So what did it actually look like? Like, if I had it on my phone, what could I do with it?
You open up the app, you get this home screen. You can either clap or make a horn noise or make a drum sound.
If you're watching it on television, then you could hear the result of your tapping. And I think one of the things that's really fascinating about the idea is that there's two elements to when fans are in the stadium cheering. First of all, when something exciting happens, there's this roar in the crowd, or if there's something terrible happens, there are these groans. But there's this other element of, you know, when you're at the game, it is a way to feel as if you are contributing, if you are helping cheer your team on. And so one of the things that fascinated us about this idea is that in an odd way, it solves both of those, because it both accounts for creating this noise, but also it's not just playing a soundtrack of fans cheering and playing the drums or sounding horns. It actually requires people to actively be engaging in creating this noise inside the stadium.
Okay, so take me to the day of the game where this was first used.
Hammam Leaf needed a win. It was late in the season, and they would have been relegated or very close to it if they hadn't won. Once the game starts and once the app is engaged, you would have heard 90,000 fans tapping their phones, and it's tense for a long time. And ultimately, it was a Hammam Leaf 1-0 victory that we suspect had something to do with the noise, but it's impossible for us to prove.
Well, that was going to be my next question. I mean, it was clearly the fan support that made them win, right?
Well, they were not an amazing team, so you have to believe it had some effect.
It sounds like a lot of time and money was put into creating this technology. Why was it never used again?
So they had this great idea, this roaring success. I don't think anybody imagined that this many people would use it. And the next year, the state of the country had calmed to the point where they felt comfortable allowing mass gatherings. People could go and attend matches. But the funny thing is, we're looking at the world now, and it's oddly relevant.
Yeah, yeah. So let's bring this story to today. As sports events begin to resume, fans are being told to stay at home, not because of political unrest, though there is plenty of that, but because of a pandemic. What have athletes been saying about what it's like to compete in these empty venues?
It's taken a lot of getting used to for everyone who's had to do it. They're all discovering, maybe for the first time in their careers, what it's like to walk out of the tunnel and see no one in the stands, hear nothing except themselves and their own thoughts sometimes. We're seeing a lot of experimentation right now with how to create a soundtrack for stadiums. In the German Bundesliga, for instance, they're giving broadcasters the option to play recordings of fans so that it doesn't feel quite as jarring on television. In Denmark, we're seeing some experimentation where one club is trying a drive-in kind of setup where 2,000 fans can just drive up and watch the game from just outside the stadium. And another club, our host, has tried putting three giant screens where fans can use Zoom to actually project themselves into the stadium. But while these are maybe a little more high-tech or a little more modern twists on the Hammam Leaf experiment, everyone who's trying something now, whether they know it or not, owes a debt of gratitude to Hammam Leaf in 2013.
So do you think we're going to see some version of this app in the next few months?
I think the question isn't, is it necessarily whether or not we see this exact app, but I think there's almost no doubt that we're going to see teams across the world doing these exact same things. American sports fans, they're used to feeling an excitement when you turn on a game and you know what you're watching is exciting and important because you see 90,000 people screaming their heads off inside this stadium. They have packed themselves in like sardines for that right to spill beer on each other and cheer. We don't know exactly what the fan situations might look like when an NFL game kicks off in September, but we do know that they need to find a way to make the experiences exciting. And you know that these sports leagues worth billions upon billions of dollars are right now, while they're trying to return, turning over every stone, trying to figure it out. And the phenomenal thing is, this Tunisian soccer team is a model for them.
Andrew Beaton and Joshua Robinson write about sports for the Wall Street Journal. We'll have a link to their piece, The 90,000 Fans Who Screamed in an Empty Stadium, at onlyagame.org. Andrew and Josh, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks, it's a pleasure.
Wyomia Tyus's dad died when she was just 15.
I became a very quiet person, not really talking very much.
Coming up, how Wyomia won back-to-back Olympic gold medals and spoke up for civil rights. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Protests over racial injustice are spreading across the country while a pandemic continues to take its toll. The next weeks and months are leading to a consequential election this November. And every day, the NPR Politics podcast is here to discuss how it could reshape your world.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, our special episode on sports, racism, and the myth of meritocracy. But now it's time for Charlie Pierce and the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell told ESPN this week that he would support and encourage an NFL team to sign Colin Kaepernick. Do you think he was crossing his fingers behind his back when he said that?
No, I think he realizes the NFL, we're not racist crowd, can say he's been out of football too long. And Goodell knows that, and that there will be enough people who find that a plausible excuse so that they don't have to do anything real about it. I mean, there's no reason to trust Roger Goodell on anything.
Meanwhile, the NFL team from Washington, D.C., whose name I do not use on the radio or elsewhere because it is racist, made Juneteenth a company-wide paid holiday. I can't. I just can't.
Well, hey, it's a good thing, okay?
It is.
The more places that make Juneteenth a holiday, the country should make it a holiday. I got no problem with that. But yes, it is incredibly ironic that the Washington racial slurs would make a big deal out of it.
Right. Right.
You know, hey, look at us. We're committed to diversity if you ignore our logo.
This week, the University of Virginia made an almost imperceptible change to its logo to remove imagery linked with slavery. The Georgia Marching Band announced it will no longer play Tara's theme from Gone with the Wind and will play Georgia on My Mind instead. And the University of Florida banned the Gator Bait chant because of good evidence that, especially during the Jim Crow era, that phrase was used to refer to black children. What do you make of all this?
The Gator Bait thing, I'll be perfectly honest with you, I did not know prior to this week, and I've gone back and looked at some of the imagery from, you know, turn of the century and the early 20th century, and it's awful.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really, really bad.
The gator bait chant started in the early 90s, and there's no evidence that the people who started it knew about the phrase's racist history. But I gotta think somebody did. And now that we all know about the history, there's just no way the chant can stand, right?
No, not now, no. And good for whoever brought it to the attention of the university and the public at large. If you dare, Google the imagery. It's awful. If there's something beyond merely racist, that imagery is it.
How many more of these racist traditions do you think still need to be addressed in college sports?
The Southeastern Conference has told the state of Mississippi to get the Confederate banner off its flag or there won't be any NCAA events in the state of Mississippi. So, I mean, that's a fairly significant move on the SEC's part.
Yeah. According to a 100-page document created by the NBA, players in the bubble league, proposed to begin on July 30th, must follow these rules. No doubles in ping pong, stay 6 feet apart during card games, no pets, and the NBA has even set up a hotline where players can snitch on each other. I might be rethinking my views on how much fun this will be.
Oh, I would apply tomorrow to be an operator on the snitch hotline. I really would. I think that would be a great gig. Plus, if you're going to make people sit 6 feet apart while they play cards, people are going to cheat. You'll never catch anybody. I'm just trying to help the NBA here.
Meanwhile, the WNBA and its players have agreed to a plan to start the 2020 season in late July. Players can decide whether they want to participate, and despite the shortened season, they will still be paid in full if they play. I really have no objections to this. You?
No, I mean, they're also doing a bubble league thing, so they're responding to the pandemic the same way the NBA is. And good for them for paying full salaries. I mean, and this sounds like a negotiation that maybe Major League Baseball could take a hint from.
In the strangest sports denial of the week, former Detroit Red Wings star Pavel Datsyuk's agent insists that his client is not inside a Russian monastery that has been taken by force by an ultra-conservative priest who denies the existence of the coronavirus. So there's that.
You know, apparently Father Sergei, who's the alleged kidnapping monk here, he took over this monastery. He chased out the person who ran the monastery and installed a perimeter of Cossacks to guard the site. Did you know there were still Cossacks? I didn't.
I did not, no.
But apparently, Pavel Datsyuk, according to his agent, is staying at a vacation cottage with his family and not anywhere near the Cossacks. So that's a good thing.
Oh, dear. And finally, Charlie, Rob Gronkowski and Shaquille O'Neal have teamed up to raise money for social justice. During a four-hour live-streamed party, the two will compete in a lip-sync battle, a game of horse jousting, and a chicken wing eating contest. Will you be watching?
I'll certainly be there for the jousting because I don't know how they're going to do that. I mean, maybe Father Sergei has some Cossacks they can borrow, but this is going to be a great take. Although I'm not entirely sure why on the video announcing this, Shaquille is sitting in front of a shower curtain. I'm a little bit vague on that. I think he could do a little bit better for stage management.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
Olympic victory ceremony, 200 meters, men.
They came out of the chute to walk out to the victory stand. I could see them.
On October 16th, 1968, Wyoming Atias and about 200 other athletes crammed into the stands at the Olympic Stadium in Mexico City to watch Americans Tommy Smith and John Carlos accept their medals.
And as they start walking, I'm looking down. I'm like, oh, they don't have their shoes on. What are they doing?
Everyone was expecting something. Smith and Carlos had been heavily involved with a group calling for a black boycott of the games to protest racial inequality. But they decided to make their stand in a different way.
And they put up their fists and it was like, my. The stadium got so quiet. I mean, just absolute silence. And then the next thing, you could start hearing people mumbling, talking. Then you start to hear voices get louder, whistling, and you hear boos and the cheers. And I kept thinking, I'm really afraid for them. And then I kept thinking, I'm afraid for my life here.
Everyone knows the story of Tommy Smith and John Carlos, but Wyomi Atias made a stand at those Olympics too, and far fewer people know her story. Wyomi Atias grew up in the Jim Crow era in a small town called Griffin, Georgia. Her father was a tenant farmer, all of her neighbors were white, and everyone got along pretty well. Wyomi called it her safe haven. Her father taught her early not to shy away from conflict.
He just wanted us to make sure we were strong people. Anything we wanted to do, we need to believe in it, fight for it. Always told us, hey, look, it's not always going to be this way. Things are going to change, and I may not see it in my lifetime, but you will.
Things did change, but not in the way Wyomia's father had hoped. One night, when Wyomia was 14, she was at church with her family. Four white men walked in. They'd come to tell Wyomia's family that their house was on fire. And just like that, Wyomia lost her safe haven. Her father fell into a deep depression. He never recovered.
Right after that, my father passed away, and that was really devastating to me. I mean, my dad was my rock, and I just, you know, I became a very quiet person, not really talking very much.
Yeah, I have a hard time picturing that.
Well, you know, it's kind of like people ask me these days, do you still run? And I say, I run my mouth now. So...
Wyomia was 15 and still in what she likes to call her quiet phase when she met Ed Temple, the women's track coach at Tennessee State. A few years later, Wyomia enrolled at that school, where the women on the team were called the Tiger Bells.
When I met the Tiger Bells, they were women that were doing things in life. These women had gone to Europe, they had gone to England, they had gone to Germany, they had gone to Russia. I'd never heard of such.
Over more than four decades coaching the Tiger Bells, Mr. Temple sent 40 women to the Olympics. His athletes won 23 medals. And that's just what Wyomi Atias wanted to do.
In 1964, I was 19.
Mr. Temple took Wyomi and the Tiger Bells to the Olympic trials. The top three sprinters would go to Tokyo. Wyomi came in third.
And he was like, don't worry about it. We're not looking for great things for you. We just think 68 gonna be your year.
But once she got to Tokyo, Wyomi started thinking she might have a shot in 64 after all. She won her first heat. In her second, she set a new Olympic record. She entered the finals undefeated.
Wyomi Atias of the U.S. set an Olympic mark in the semifinals.
I said in my head, I could win a gold medal. And then I started thinking, why am I thinking like this? I'm going to get the big head. I don't want that.
She runs her rivals into the ground to reach the tape in 11 and 4/10 seconds.
Edith McGuire, who's my best friend, after the race, she runs up to me. Tyus, you won, you won. I said, I did? She said, yeah. I said, what did you get? And she said, I got second.
Yes, the American Eagle flies high in Tokyo.
Wyomi says she and Edith were treated with respect by the Japanese. But when they returned home, they were reminded of the way things were. Blacks had to sit in the back of the bus, drink from a different water fountain. They didn't have equal opportunities, and they didn't receive a hero's welcome after winning gold and silver at the Olympics.
Edith and I are both from Georgia. She's from Atlanta, Georgia. They only gave us the parade in the black neighborhood. They didn't give us a parade throughout Atlanta. You're talking about the 60s, and that was not much they were doing for people of color.
Wyomi and Edith weren't the only black athletes who noticed they'd been treated better abroad than at home. As the 1968 games approached, Wyomi started hearing about calls for black athletes to boycott the Olympics in Mexico City.
I say I heard about it. It's not like a call and we talked about it on the phone. We were just not contacted as women. They just felt like, they'll go along with whatever we say.
Eventually, most athletes decided they had more to lose by staying at home than they did by competing in Mexico City. So they went, and it was there that the organizers of the movement, now called the Olympic Project for Human Rights, finally held a meeting and invited everyone, including the women.
We were trying to talk about what could we do as a group, and nobody could come up with one thing. So we just left it as, you know, whatever you would like to do will be okay. And then when Tommy and Carlos did what they did on the victory stand, it, you know, it was so powerful. It was nothing for anybody else to do.
Tommy Smith and John Carlos, the Olympic 200 meters gold and bronze medalists, had been suspended by the United States Olympic Committee and given 48 hours to leave Mexico.
By the time Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists, Wyoming Attias had already made Olympic history by becoming the first person to repeat as 100-meter champion. In the final, instead of wearing her uniform shorts, white with red and blue trim, she'd worn black shorts in support of the Olympic Project for Human Rights. No one had noticed her quiet protest. But Wyoming had one more race to run, the 4x100-meter relay.
After the relay, we went into the press room, and reporters are just all over us about what Tommy and Carlos had done, and what do you think about this?
In 1968, Wyoming was just starting to come out of her quiet phase. She still hadn't said more than a word or two at a time to reporters.
Well, they asked me a question, yes, no, I don't know, maybe so.
But this time, when reporters asked what she thought, Wyoming had something to say. What is there to think, she said. They made a statement. We all know that we're fighting for human rights. That's what they stood for on the victory stand. Human rights for everyone, everywhere. And to support that and to support them, I'm dedicating my medal to them. I believe in what they did.
I found my voice. You know, there's certain things in life that makes you change. And for me, it makes me become a better person, made me become the person I am.
But while Wyoming had changed, life back home still had not. Nobody was interested in putting a black woman on a pedestal, not even the first ever back-to-back gold medalist in the 100 meters.
Mr. Temple had prepared us, and he would always tell us all the time, you know, you could go to the Olympic Games, you could win 10 gold medals, but you come back here, they don't really care. They give you a parade and a key that doesn't work.
Wyoming kept fighting. She moved to California, helped establish the Women's Sports Foundation, and continued to champion for equal rights. And while she says she sometimes looks around and wonders if she's back in 1968, she has one lasting reminder that not everything is the same as it was 50 years ago. In 1999, Wyoming was asked to come back to her hometown of Griffin, Georgia, for the opening of the Wyoming Attias Olympic Park. She thought they'd put it in the black neighborhood. She thought it would be small. But when she arrived, she discovered that her park was huge, 168 acres with soccer fields and baseball fields, hiking trails, and a pond you can fish in. The town even put together a torch ceremony, with Wyoming running the last lap.
One of the officials in Griffin came up to me and he just said, Wyoming, we hope this makes up for the things we didn't do.
Did it make up for what they didn't do before?
I didn't look at it as a makeup. I looked at it more that the people in the town has grown. It takes time. I know we would like to see things move a lot quicker. I just keep thinking about my dad saying, you know, it's not always going to be this way. People are going to change. Here it is 50 years later and a lot more people are aware of what's going on. A lot more people are standing up and speaking out. In order for this to be a better world to live in, that's what we have to do.
That story first aired in 2018. Wyoming Attias wrote a book. It's called Tiger Bell, The Wyoming Attias Story. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.